Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Mick Clifford Podcast with the Irish Examiner. Now, my guest today spent a long career working in the law, first as a barrister and for 7 years as a High Court judge, during which time he presided over several high-profile defamation cases and managed the jury list for the civil courts. Bernard Barton retired in 2021 but has maintained a keen interest in his former career. He's active in writing and researching in both the law and history, and he has a special interest in proposals around changes to our defamation laws, specifically a proposal to abolish juries. He passionately believes in the role of juries in our courts. Recently, he sat down with me to discuss this, as well as changes he observed over the years in relations between judges and politicians, and why retirees like himself could be of further use to the administration of the law today. Bernard, people would have known your long career as a High Court judge, but I suppose what people would not perhaps be aware is that you're actually a descendant of Robert Barton, one of the signatories of the treaty.
Well, I'd love to claim that I was a direct descendant of Robert Barton. I did know him, but I'm not a direct descendant because Robert's two brothers and himself, they all volunteered, like so many other Irish, to fight in the Great War. And his two brothers were killed in action in France. He didn't marry until very late in life. And his two sisters, they never married at all. So that whole branch of the family has died out. But I got to know him. My grandfather was friendly with him. There's an ancestral connection, but it's way back. But socially, we knew, he was friendly with my grandfather.
And he was as well in just, most people will know, but some wouldn't. Of course, he was a first cousin of Erskine Childers, who had a major role in the revolutionary period and then was executed in the Civil War. And an interesting feature too, I think, from Barton's background, they're actually unionists originally, his family.
Correct. All my family were unionists. Southern unionists. And there's a big difference between Southern unionists and Northern unionists. Big difference is that Southern unionists favoured and supported Home Rule.
Yes.
And that all came out in the convention, the Constitution Convention of 1917-1918. But obviously within union, so they it's a bit like Scotland today. They supported the idea of self-government, but within the United Kingdom, that was basically a good encapsulation of the Southern Unionist position. So yes, and Robert Barton and Erskine Childers, they were staunch unionists. And so one of the interesting things is the migration. How did Robert Barton and Erskine Childers migrate from being staunch unionists and from that background to being revolutionaries? It's an interesting
kind
of story.
Like, yeah, and few people made that journey, all right, but it is interesting, particularly when they played such a central role in the formation of the state at the time. Your own background then, Bernard, you grew up in Dublin, you're from a kind of a business background, father was involved in business.
Yes, my grandfather was English. Both my grandfathers were English, as it happens, married to Irish women. And after the First World War, they both served in the First World War. My grandfather got the idea that cars would be a coming thing. And so he got involved in importing cars and agricultural machinery into Ireland. And so that was actually became quite a successful business. And so I grew up in that with that background. There had been lawyers in England, in the family background, but business was and agriculture was his particular interest, and Robert Barton had a particular interest in developing modern agriculture in Ireland. So I think they were quite friendly. You know, they had common interests that way. I did go into the family business. I read law in UCD when I left school, but at the end of that, my father said, "Listen, enough learning. It's time to get into the business. It's time to go and earn a crust." And so I went into the business. But actually, I met I hadn't quite finished university at that time, but I was doing summer work in the business. And Robert Barton called in to see my father or my grandfather, I can't remember which. I think they might have been both there. My granddad still had an interest in the business. And my father phoned over to the department where I was. He said, come over here. He said, there's somebody you'll be interested in meeting. And sure enough, it was Robert. And he asked me, he said, well, what were you doing? And I told him I was reading law. And he was delighted to hear that, you see. And then he said, well, what do you think you'll do with yourself? Thinking I might have said, well, I'm going to become a solicitor or a barrister, or at least one of that. And I said, well, I think I might be going into the business, because, of course, my father was in the room listening to this conversation. And he said, well, don't give up the idea, I said, of going to the bar. He said, it's a really interesting profession. It's a good profession, he said. And he said, there's great satisfaction to be derived as a barrister from serving other people. Robert Barton was a great man for public service, as he proved in his whole, in his life. But I never forgot that. And yeah, after a few years in the business, I took his advice and went to the bar.
And I saw somewhere, and you obviously you were in the motor business, so you had your own car at that stage, but your father thought perhaps it might be best to give back the car if you were moving out.
Well, when I was in the crisis decision, having just got married, will I go to the bar or will I stay in the business? The business was thriving. It was a very big business. I mean, we were motor retailers, distributors and importers. You know, it was a huge, from my perspective as a boy, man, you know, young man in his 20s, it looked like, you know, this was a serious business to be in. And there was little, you know, comments every now and again, this business will be yours someday, you know, sort of comments. Yeah. To, but the women in my life, my wife, my mother, an aunt, they were all saying, why don't you go to the bar? You talk the hind leg off a donkey. Would you not go to the bar? Give it a try anyway. So, yeah, so the day came, I said, right, I'll do that. And I went in, I was called down to the office the day I was leaving. I knew it was my father, you know, wanted to say something to me. And the pot it was, I said, keys. So I, in those days, I think it was driving a Jaguar car, which was a company car. And the keys, I thought it was a strange sort of request. I took the keys out, put it into his hand, and he closed his hand like that. And he said, you know, this, you know, you'll thank me for this. And I didn't feel that way, I have to say, as I was walking home. But yeah, it was basically, you know, the bridges were now down. It was an encouragement to make sure. You know, that there was no coming back to the business. You leaving now, you're going to the bar, make the best of it, pal.
Yeah, yeah.
this door is shut. Door, yeah. I didn't see that at the time, but no. I was grateful for it afterwards.
I'm just curious on that, and in your experience, and you 2021, you're retired. From your observation, would it be very different for people starting out in the bar today than it was in your time? And would it be, I suppose, in general terms, more difficult or easier?
Well, it was always difficult.
Yeah.
I remember, I think, just to give you an example of that, I think we were the biggest intake the year I was called to the bar, was 1977. There were 72 of us, I think, in the class called. It was the biggest call up until that time. And of that, I think 43 came down to go into practice. And I'm saying a decade later, maybe a bit more, 15 years, there were, that I know of, 12 left. So the rate of attrition was heavy then. And it's as heavy now.
Yeah, that's interesting.
If not more so, because, of course, there are a lot more people at the bar. And now you have classes of double that, you know, coming down 150, 140, 150. There was a huge fallout from the bar over COVID, as you can imagine. But I mean, so I think you have to be careful about looking at, say, events like COVID and the consequences it would have on people, you know, trying to practice at the bar. If you take that out, that experience out, there was still quite, as a venture of the King's Inns, we would get a list of people every year who are wanting to disbar themselves. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people on that list. People who maybe have tried to practice 6, 7, 8, 9 years and leaving because they're just not able to make it at the bar. So it's very tough.
And there is an image, particularly when we see it, for example, when we see the likes of legal costs and there's so much going for counsel, etc. And that, there is an image that once you get in there, you know, it's pretty handy and all that. You're talking about a very small minority ultimately that make it that far, it would seem.
Absolutely. There's no doubt. And the bar itself, the bar council, doesn't dispute the fact that people who are a bit like the cream in a bottle of milk that get to the top, they make very substantial incomes. There's no doubt about that. But for the vast majority of people at the bar, it's an existence nearly. You know, they make a good living. But that's about as much as you could put at it. And there's an awful lot of people struggling. But that's not an image people like to even admit.
No. You were a long time on the High Court bench yourself, and you spent a lot of time managing the civil juries list for a number of years.
I did.
That would have given you a panoramic view, really, of what was going on in the courts and trends and that kind of thing.
It did. I think it's fair to say that the court system didn't keep up. It wasn't resourced proportionately to the expansion of the Irish economy. So you still had a disproportionate number of judges and courts to the population. And we ended up in a situation by the time I was appointed in the noughties where of all of the European countries, Ireland had the least number of judges per head of the population of any country in the European Union, including the Eastern Bloc countries. And not only were we at the bottom, we were like a whole division below the next country. We were so disproportionately represented. And that created, especially you can imagine, most people listening to this podcast will be aware of how successful the Irish economy became in the noughties and before. But the court system was simply unable to cope with the demands which were put on it. Huge areas of business which didn't even exist when I went into the bar. For example, family law was in its infancy when I went to the bar in 1977. It's a huge element in our lifetime. And commercial court, for example, is another, you know, commercial activity and commercial litigation. It became massive with the development of the Irish economy. But the courts lagged way behind in terms of resourcing. Now, the government has recently, you know, tried to address that by increasing the number of judges in each court. I think there's recently been 10 High Court judges appointed now to the High Court, which are badly needed.
And, of course, the implication for that is that people accessing the courts, they're subjected to very long waits. And like anybody facing into a legal action, everything that goes along with that, the stress, everything, all kind of suspended because getting access to the court.
It's dreadful. It surprised me that the state wasn't sued more often than it was over delays in the court system. And, in fact, you know, the Commission and the European Court of Justice had indicated that there was a necessity and an imperative on the state to provide for access to justice for its citizens. And but that needs and needed resourcing. And so that's the real problem about delays and the consequences of that for litigants was a lack of resourcing. That was my whole experience.
Something I'm curious about myself, that the odd time I've gone down the court, so I've noticed it more, and I think it's developed very much since the economic crash in 2008, and that is the prevalence of lay litigants.
Yeah.
Did you see that develop over the latter part of your career?
I did.
And how do you think, first of all, it's handled? How does it impact on the courts? Quite obviously, everybody has a right to do it should they want to.
Yes, no, absolutely. The real difficulty that you encountered, that I encountered myself as a judge when faced with a lay litigant, is that very often a lay litigant would be at sea, to put it mildly, in relation to the law. You had to recognise the right of that citizen to present his or her case, but they would very often be looking to you to guide them on the law. Well, of course, I'm bound as a judge to be impartial. And so if there's another party in the case, as there would be, albeit represented, you would have to behave in such a way as to maintain the impartiality and not to allow the other litigant in the case to think that because it was a lay litigant, the lay litigant was getting an advantage in the case which he or she shouldn't have. So that was I found that very difficult to it's a difficult tightrope to walk, to try to help, but not so much as to become an advocate yourself for the cause that they were. There were, of course, people who misused the system. And there are people like that in every walk of life, and people got a taste for bringing cases about all sorts of things.
I could think of one or two.
Yes, there's some very well known individuals, and basically, the courts have developed a system of I should say maybe weeding out the genuine lay litigant from somebody who is literally using this as a sort of a pastime to air their views, which of course is not the purpose of the court.
I mean, just when you were talking, it struck me, it's a small bit like, I don't know if you remember that during the Rugby World Cup, one of Ireland's big games, where Jonathan Sexton approached the referee and he said, "Hey, you're coaching the other side, you can't be doing that."
And that's what you have to try and avoid. And it's difficult at times. You'd want to say something, and it really was necessary for the lay litigant to understand what it was you were trying to say to him about the law, but without the other litigant saying, "Hey, listen."
Yeah, exactly. I can imagine.
What shirt are you wearing? You know, exactly.
And in some areas of the law, we've seen, you know, it's developed in various ways, particularly in recent years. And if you take one example, just struck me, in personal injuries, we've new guidelines came in there a number of years ago, and a number of members of the judiciary were opposed to them. And one of the reasons, as I understand it, were opposed was they felt it would have impinged on judicial discretion. And what would your opinion be on the likes of that?
Well, I need to be careful about that. Making comment about that, because there's litigation.
Well, in broadest terms, the concept
at the moment about that, but I think it would be no secret. It is no secret that I was opposed, and that the High Court judges who were, if you like, in the firing line, they were the ones who had to deal with the serious, very serious personal injury cases, that they were opposed. They were unanimously opposed to the guidelines as proposed, not to the concept of guidelines, but to the guidelines as proposed. And one of the areas of opposition, one of the grounds for opposition, was undoubtedly that they were far too restrictive on judicial discretion. I mean, the whole idea of an independent judiciary is that it is independent to administer the law in accordance with the law. And there was an element, I suppose, about the guidelines as proposed, which restricted that, which in our view fettered that discretion to a degree which meant that actually a judge might not be able to award compensation in a particular case which the judge considered, in accordance with legal principles, was a fair and reasonable sum to compensate that person for the injury they suffered. And so that is... No, they did pass, but by a fairly small minority.
Yeah, different opinions. Yeah, it's interesting.
The jury, if I could put it that way,
is still
out on that.
And just, I suppose, a separate issue that came through the Judicial Council. Judicial Council is relatively new
It is.
Concept. A positive development?
I think absolutely a positive development. I think it's a bit like the new constitution when it came in 1937. It takes a time to basically say, you know, what does this really mean, and how can we, you know, how far should we go in making representations? I think myself that the whole purpose of the Judicial Council, you know, its actual stated purpose for it, you know, was to give the judiciary a proper voice, whilst respecting the separation of powers. And I think there is a conservative, I would say, the approach of the Judicial Council is that we should maintain what was always traditionally at the position of the judiciary, that, you know, we do not interfere or make public comments about anything which is in the sphere of the legislature. And basically, we should avoid making comments about anything which is other than legal matters. But I think that there are pieces of legislation, for example, which might have an impact on the public good, that the Judicial Council should consider, I think should consider, if there's a judicial view, shall we say, on perhaps some proposal. And given the way in which the Oireachtas is now established, you know, the committees in the Oireachtas, like the Justice Committee, I think, I believe myself, so not a question of thinking, I actually believe myself that in important measures like that, the Oireachtas Committee on Justice, for example, would welcome the view of the Judicial Council, perhaps on a proposal. But I think the Judicial Council at the moment thinks, no, this is crossing the Rubicon, maybe we should. Whereas I don't agree with that. I actually think I can understand that view is taken.
You'd be bringing expertise to the table in that respect if the Oireachtas was passing a law.
Correct. And it is simply, you're simply communicating a view. You're not telling the Oireachtas what they should or shouldn't do. It's a matter entirely and exclusively for the Oireachtas to decide what piece of legislation they should or shouldn't pass.
I suppose what some people might say with the opposite view is that if the Judicial Council presented a particular view and if the Oireachtas didn't go along with it, which they would of course be perfectly entitled to, would there be any feeling then that they're not going to like this? Do you know what I mean? I suppose that could play into it.
And that may, I don't know. I'm not privy to this. It may, because it's a relatively new body. I think the judicial guidelines were the first real sort of thing. And then I retired shortly after that. So I'm sure that is probably one element of it. But I suppose in the United Kingdom, for example, they get a judicial view, you know, maybe a view of certainly the senior judiciary, because of course there are law lords in the House of Lords, which if you like the Senate. So they get views that way. We don't have a mechanism, and I actually don't see why the Judicial Council might not think about that. I mean, it would be, after all, it is a body which is speaking for the judges, for the judiciary.
And just, I suppose, in a similar vein, just in terms of your experience, there would have been occasions when the Oireachtas would have been perceived as crossing that separation of powers. Like, without giving you any state secrets, anecdotally, you and your colleagues, would there have been times when you might have said, I don't know, this is impinging on our patch kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? Without saying so officially.
That's probably one of the big changes I've noticed in my own lifetime, over 50 years. I mean, if somebody in the political world criticised a judge, I mean, really had a go at a judge, or basically said, you know, the judges are not fit for purpose, or you know, either one judge or a particular or group of judges, you could guarantee that the political parties across the Dáil and in the Senate, they would defend. They would basically say, hey, listen, this is trespassing on the sphere of the judiciary. We don't go there. I mean, you don't say those things. So there would, if you like, the judiciary would never need to say anything, because they could always rely on the political establishment to defend the judiciary. knowing full well that the convention was that the judiciary would say nothing. It was part of the deal, so to speak, of creating an independent judiciary and appointing people to judicial office with all the power that carries, that they do not say anything about legislation, about the legislative sphere. It's if you like, a clear distinction. There's a reason for the separation of powers, and it's essential to the health of our democracy. And part of the deal is that judiciary do not say anything. But in the past, it was always the case that position was respected. And if it was broken, the politicians themselves would defend it and say, listen, you're stepping out of line now. That's not so evident now. I think that's the big change now, is that and I think that's a bit discomforting and disquieting, that you can't now rely on a unified approach by members of the Oireachtas on that issue.
That's interesting, because I just wonder, is it one of the things that, when things are going all right in that respect for so long, that we take for granted? I mean, if you look at two places, just strike me off the top of my head, Israel and Poland, where there are issues ongoing over impinging on the independence of the judiciary. I think actually one of your colleagues may have gone in support to Poland, what was going on there. And are we at a stage where we're taking that independence for granted? And as you said, the old conventions that used to be there are not adhered to in the other arm of the state,
Well, that's correct. And unfortunately, the lines are getting more and more blurred. And it is one of the reasons why I have taken the unusual step, although I am now retired, and I am, if you like, freer than I would have been had I been a serving judge. And I totally respect the concept of the separation of powers and these conventions. But I think that our democracy is under threat. I mean, what happened last Thursday,
The riots in Dublin.
It's just, and unfortunately, there is, I think, in the system, there's a drive for control, and the elements of democracy, which are so important to our democracy, I believe, are under attack. And the most recent iteration of this is a proposal by the government, well, by the Minister for Justice in particular, to abolish the right to trial by jury. I mean, trial by jury is the quintessence of our democracy. And I would say it's very difficult for people to challenge or criticise a judgment which has been made by 12 citizens. It's much more difficult to challenge that decision than it is to challenge the decision of a judge.
Are we talking about the area of defamation here?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's just in that particular provision. I think it's not commonly known that all civil wrongs, I mean, we're not just talking about criminal offences now, but all civil wrongs in the High Court, for serious civil wrongs, are tribal as of right by jury. And the concept of jury trial is as old as the law itself. It's actually considered to be so important. It was provided for in Magna Carta. So it's been part of our law for 800 years. So a proposal by the government to actually take away this right is not just stripping the citizen of his or her right to choose the mode by which a defamation action, and now it's, at this stage it's only in defamation, it should be tried. In other words, the citizen has the choice. The litigant citizen has the choice. Will I have a judge, or will I have a judge and a jury? So the government want to take away that choice. That's the first thing. But the consequence of taking away the choice is that the public are removed from the administration of justice. So those who advocate for the removal of jury trial, saying, well, we don't need it, we just let a judge decide it, they're actually, I don't think that this is something which the public really appreciate. What they're actually saying is, we don't want the public any more involved in the administration of justice. Now, that is about as undemocratic a position as you can probably imagine.
Okay, no, just to touch on that with you, Myrne,
this is not the first time that's happened. I mean, it happened in 1988 when the right to trial by jury was taken away in personal injury actions. It was abolished in personal injury actions. And in those days, the claims being made for the abolition of jury trial in personal injury actions in the late 1980s were that legal costs would go down, awards would go down, you get clear judgments from a judge, appeals would go down, and insurance premiums would go down. Exactly the opposite happened. The legal process became longer because there were more appeals. There were more appeals because it's easier to appeal a decision of a judge than it is a jury. And legal costs went up with the damages. So awards went up. The cases became longer, not shorter. And insurance premiums followed suit. The exact opposite. And the same, so the exact opposite of what was being claimed occurred, as we know. And the same claims that were made then are now being made to support the abolition of jury trial, of the right to trial by jury in defamation proceedings. They are saying the costs will go down, trials will be shorter, and we'll have a decision of a judge, altogether a better result. The exact opposite is going to happen.
Okay, and I suppose just to fill listeners in a small bit, there are major proposals to change the law on defamation.
There are.
And these include, as you mentioned, I suppose possibly the most controversial is the abolition of juries. There's also kind of elements like a simplification of the defence of fair and reasonable publication on a matter of public interest, a more media-friendly defence for an unexpected defamatory comment during a live broadcast, which I think is an issue. And there are other measures to deal with kind of strategic lawsuits, I think slaps or whatever they're called,
exactly.
That kind of thing. But, and it's just two elements strike me about it, Bernard. One, it is the case, and you made the point about personal injury, but it is the case that in the vast majority of civil litigation now, there is no jury. The defamation is the only one really left that is a matter of course. Am I wrong in that?
Completely wrong.
Right, okay.
But sorry, you're in good company. In fact, it was said, it's even been said by some members of the Supreme Court in recent judgments, that there are only a few cases in which there's a right to trial by a jury. Now, actually, funny enough, as the jury... the head of the Civil Juries Division of the High Court, I was invited by the Court Service to write a book on civil jury trial. And so it's taken me 2 years to do that. I've just finished it. And as a result of that, I made discoveries myself, which I wouldn't have been aware of at the time when I started the book. And I had that impression myself that there were really just a few causes of action, as they're called, which are tribal by jury as of right. I discovered I was completely wrong about that. And that, in fact, all civil wrongs of a serious nature are tribal as of right by jury.
What about in practice?
In practice, the main cases, and I mean, I headed up that list, so I have a very good knowledge of it. In practice, the right is exercised. And I mean, that's the point. People, simply because people don't have a jury or don't ask for a jury, doesn't mean to say that the right can be ignored. They have a choice to make. When you go to serve notice of trial, the notice of trial says, do you want a jury or not? And now, many people opt to have a trial by judge alone, which is fine. But they have the decision.
Right.
They make the decision as to which they want, or their solicitor does on their behalf. Invariably, though, in cases involving the fundamental rights of the citizen, so each one of us has got fundamental rights guaranteed by the Constitution. So our right, for example, to bodily integrity, our right to a good name, our right to free speech, our right to liberty. So where the fundamental rights of the citizen are involved, the vast majority of cases in the High Court, the one or other of the parties looks for a trial with a jury.
Right.
And I think this is something which is really not understood, that all the fundamental rights of the citizen. So if you were, say, wrongfully arrested, or you were prosecuted when you shouldn't have been prosecuted, or you were assaulted, whether by, I'm now, by anybody, I mean, I'm not talking about a police officer hitting you with a bat. Yeah. I mean, I'm talking about any intentional wrong on the citizen, committed on the citizen. So any assault, battery, wrongful arrest. You know, I'm talking about maybe a person shopping in a shopping centre and they're taken into a room against their will because they're suspected of shoplifting. I'm not just talking about police actions. I mean, this could be any private citizens or, you know, groups of citizens, nothing to do with the police. But in any case, in all cases now involving the constitutional rights of the citizen as a person, to their integrity, to their freedom, to their liberty, those are all triable as a right by jury. And included in those constitutional rights is the right to a good name.
Yeah.
So, in funny enough, if peculiarly enough, if this proposal was to be proceeded with, the only constitutional right in which there wouldn't be a right to trial by jury is for a good name. All others would still be triable as a right by a jury.
That is something
which I think is not fully appreciated by people.
To know what's really happening, subscribe to the Irish Examiner today at irishexaminer.com/subscribe.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Now, can I give you a view, perhaps, in terms of where I'd be coming from as in the media, and I'm not speaking for anyone in the media, but this is, I would guess, one line that people within the media would have, and that is that we're talking about democracy under threat in various ways, and some people are suggesting, particularly with the evolution of the internet and that the issue of free press is under threat in various ways. And you can go all the way back to Thomas Jefferson with his famous quote, if you had a choice between a world in which you had newspapers and no government, or a world in which you had government or no newspapers, he would choose the former on the basis of people weren't able to talk about it. You're not going to enable democracy. Now, some people in the media would suggest that because for financial reasons as much as anything, because of the way things have evolved, that the concept of a free press is under threat. And following on from that, there would be suggestions that one of the issues that arises there is that the defamation laws and the views of the media are very onerous. And one of the things there is the issue of when you're sued, going to court, the cost of it, and what people believe in the media would believe is the unpredictability of the kind of awards that can be given out and whether they're genuinely proportionate. And the attitude there is that having a jury in that trial makes it far more unpredictable and therefore far more costly. What would you say to that argument?
Well, I'm well used to that argument. And I would say that there is merit in the argument which was obeyed 40 years ago by the media, or 30 years ago by media proprietors mainly, and then senior journalists like yourself and editors, that there was a tendency of juries to give unpredictable awards, and sometimes grossly disproportionate awards, starting, I think, with De Rossa in 1999, and going straight through past into the last decade, with cases like Independent Newspapers versus Ireland, and McDonough. So there was, and I have to recognise this, there was some basis for complaint and for concern. But what has been blurred, and it's a really good example of blurring, is the recent review of the 2009 Act, which is required by the Act itself, the 2009 Defamation Act. I read with interest the submissions by the media owners to the review. And what struck me about this is the cases that they were relying on, like De Rossa, like Independent Newspapers and Ireland, like McDonough, these were all cases involving the 1961 Defamation Act,
right,
not the 2009 Act. So they were making submissions, perfectly valid submissions, vis-a-vis the inadequacies of the 61 Act, but that had no bearing at all on the 2009 Act. And I think some of the submissions which were made and were repeated to the Oireachtas Joint Committee on Justice by the media representatives were completely disingenuous. And I'll give you for an example. The media representatives in written submissions to the Justice Review on the 2009 Act and repeated in the Oireachtas Joint Committee on Justice was that the European Court of Human Rights had specifically castigated Ireland in an Independent Newspapers versus Ireland case, and it basically said that the laws were inadequate to protect the rights of the citizen, and that essentially it created a situation in which you could end up, as happened in that case, with a massive award which was completely disproportionate. I accept all of that. And do you know that operated as a chilling effect, I think was to actually use the word, a chilling effect on the freedom of speech, which is another constitutional guarantee. Now, everything about that was correct, except there was a full stop then. So when you read that part of the judgment, which was read back to the Oireachtas, and which was put into the... But there's a full stop there. That's all that's said about the Europe. And what's said about it is incorrect. But those observations by the European Court of Human Rights were in relation to the 1961 Act, not the 2009 Act. Yes. And in the judgment then went on to say that the court recognised the 2009 Act and the provisions for safety and guaranteeing the rights of all, including the right in the 2009 Act, but there's no mention of that.
Right.
So I would have expected of all of the people who are interested in the Fourth Estate, who are interested in the protection of democracy, why was that left out? Why was that not mentioned? Why was it down to people like me to draw the attention of the Oireachtas Committee to that?
I suppose you'd be well used in your own job, you'd be well used to people putting forward
their own. Sure, I know. But this is why it's necessary to hear both sides of the case. So I'm just giving that as
an
it's an important example of information which is correct as far as it goes, but actually creates a completely disingenuous conclusion unless the facts are laid out in front of you. And I would say there's another very important development, which I'm responsible for myself. I don't like saying that, but until the case of Higgins versus the Irish Aviation Authority.
There's initially, I think, an award of 10 million.
This is what I'm coming to. In Higgins, this is a very recent case, as you know, we're talking about 2019-2020. And I think for listeners to understand this, in De Rossa, the very point which is being made now by the media, it's unpredictable. You don't know what the jury is going to do in any case. They raised the point on appeal in the Supreme Court, in De Rossa, saying that the only way to deal with this, and that the proper way to deal with this, and what's wrong here, is that the judge didn't give the jury essentially guidance on what compensation they should be giving for the case. Because the judge, of course, has been listening to these cases, you know, for weeks and weeks, would be able to give them some reasonable guidance. Now, for reasons which the Supreme Court set out in De Rossa, they said you can't do that. It's a rule of practice. Because to do that is to trespass on the preserve of the jury.
Yeah.
Right. The 2009 Act then comes along, and basically the law, that was the common law at the time. Whether you think it's right or wrong, that was the common law. It was a rule of practice that barristers and the trial judge did not actually mention figures to a jury. It's now transpired that actually what the 2009 Act did, it changed that. It actually said that the judge had to give the jury directions, instructions on the law in relation to everything but every issue that the jury had to decide, but also in relation to damages. Right. And counsel were able to do the same thing.
A guide of some sort.
Exactly. But what it didn't say was, it didn't make it clear that what this meant was that the judge could go further and say to the jury, I think, ladies and gentlemen, that in all the circumstances of this case, the appropriate range of compensation in this case is between A and D.
As in actual figures, when you say?
In figures. Yeah, or, basically, the range of not less than this and not more than that. This is a kind of a range. But that wasn't spelled out. I think that was the intention in the bill, but it wasn't actually spelled out in the Act. And actually, in the Higgins case, counsel for the defendant made a submission to me and said, Judge, I think this is what Section 31 means. I think you actually, and I want to say that to the jury. There had been recently Court of Appeal. I said, well, you need to get some authority for that proposition. I mean, on what basis can I depart from De Rossa? And he said, well, the 2009 Act came after De Rossa, and, you know, Kinsella, the Supreme Court in Kinsella has said that there seemed to be no reason why the law as it now is that the judge shouldn't tell a jury. So I acceded to the application, and I told counsel, I directed that counsel were at liberty to mention figures. And I mentioned them myself.
Right.
The case ended up in the Supreme Court. On its way, it went to the Court of Appeal. Now, there was no criticism, I need to tell you, about the charge to the jury. There was no criticism about that. The appeal was basically on the level of damages. So the jury were told about figures. They told what a paraplegic could get, for example, in general damages. They were told what in other types of cases of the same as the one that they had to, the kind of awards which would be made. So they got all this information, and they came up with an award of, I think, €300,000. That was appealed to the 375,000, I think, was the total award, because there were different aspects. That case came to the Court of Appeal. The Court of Appeal took away 80% of the award. They decided the jury was completely wrong. Now, the Court of Appeal said there was absolutely nothing wrong with the judge's charge to the jury. In fact, they said my charge to the jury was a model of clarity. That's how they described it. But they still took away 80%. Now, here's a worrying I think it's a genuinely worrying matter. The report on the 2009 review of the 2009 Act, on which the current proposal is based to abolish the retry, relies heavily on the result of the decision in Higgins in the Court of Appeal. It points to the fact that in Higgins, 80% of the award was taken away, and it relies on the Court of Appeal decision as a basis for the proposition to abolish the right to trial by jury, as an example of how bonkers a jury can be. What, of course, it doesn't tell you is what happened in the Supreme Court. And the decision in the Supreme Court was handed down a month after the publication of the report.
Right.
And the decision
didn't take account of that.
Exactly.
The report, obviously.
And what happened in the Supreme Court is the Supreme Court unanimously reversed the Court of Appeal as being wholly wrong. So we now have a proposal being considered by the government on the basis that no longer exists, completely being reversed by the Supreme Court. And what the Supreme Court decided to do was, they decided that the approach we had taken was correct, but that they would actually themselves set out for all future defamation actions to deal with these complaints, fair complaints by the media. From now on, the jury are going to be directed by a judge on the appropriate level of competence level. So in other words, they're going to be given parameters, guidance.
Yeah.
And that will answer this business about proportionality and about consistency. So that's, from now on, that's the law. It's already the law. But this has not been considered at all by the government, because this change in the law, momentous change, came after the report.
That's
which is a very important thing. It's never mentioned at all in any media group. So no. When the media are commenting on this in any paper, no one talks about Higgins.
Right.
Because to talk about Higgins is actually the answer to the otherwise legitimate complaints made by the media. And this, I would say, to top all this off, is that the Oireachtas Committee, recognising this, wanting to have a democratic input through the decision of the jury as to whether or not somebody has or hasn't been defamed, have decided that from now on, while the jury would be able to give an indicative award on the basis of the guidelines in Higgins, the final decision will be down to the judge. So the very thing that the media have been looking for you, a judge will decide the level of compensation in every defamation case if that proposal is put into law. But instead of abolishing juries altogether, judges will now decide at the end of the case for the amount of the compensation.
So are we talking really, like, just to make a comparison, may not be totally appropriate, but in the criminal courts, a jury decides on the facts, the judge decides on the
correct
sentence. Are we saying here the jury will decide on the facts, the judge will decide on the amount in the event of
the jury will be allowed, like in a lot of United States, for example, and in Canada and some Commonwealth countries, the jury can say what they think should happen. They should say, well, we think, they can actually recommend, they think, it's up to you, judge, as to what sentence you will, but we actually think, you know, you should get the electric chair or whatever. Do you know?
Yeah.
They're entitled to give an indicative view.
I'm with you.
And from now on, the jury, that's if the Oireachtas Joint Committee proposal is enacted, the jury will be entitled to give an indicative award. They say, we think X is fair, but it's been made clear in the proposed legislation that the judge, It will not be bound by that, and that the judge can depart from that and can give the award. But if he does that or she does that, they have to give reasons as to why they're departing from the view of the jury.
Right.
So I think it's unlikely myself that there will be much departure, because if the judge has instructed the jury properly on the parameters and the jury decide to make an award in those parameters which he or she has given them, on what basis then is the judge going to disagree with that? But you could see a situation where if the jury decide to disagree with that and go into a much higher level or a lower level, the judge could say, well, look, I don't think there's any basis for the jury to depart from the guidelines I've given them.
But could you have a scenario that if a jury does that and departs from the guidelines, that the judge, when it comes forward, the judge ultimately says, well, fair enough, they departed, that's their decision. Is that possible?
Absolutely. The judge could say, well, that's their decision, but the law is clear. I'm not bound by their decision. And in my view, they shouldn't have departed from the... He or she...
No, but sorry, my question is, if they do depart, can the judge say, well, okay, they departed, that's their decision, I'll go along with that?
The judge could do that.
But it's unlikely, I suppose.
But it's highly unlikely. I think if he or she has said, you see, the Supreme Court have indicated that they feel that the trial judge should have a discussion with counsel.
Yeah.
On both sides, before the jury is charged at all, and have a discussion with them, get their views as to what parameters, gentlemen, do you, or ladies and gentlemen, do you think this case falls in? If the jury come to the question of damages, where do you say?
Yeah.
So that's a discussion which takes place between a trial judge and the lawyers in open court in relation to the issue paper, as to what questions the jury are to be asked. So as part of that conversation, the Supreme Court is now saying you have a discussion about the level of damages, if the jury come to decide that. So the trial judge will know when he or she is giving the jury parameters,
yes,
in which pretty well what the views of counsel are as well.
Yeah,
do you know? So the chances, I think, and also the parameters are a bit wider than they would be, that they're much wider. They're a good example of what the personal injury guidelines are not. There are wider parameters. There's a proper area for discretion. In other words, it's not too restrictive, not too
limited. Politics, the art of the possible.
I know. So what I'm saying is, I personally feel that this should be tried, that we should try this. And I think in particular, jury, just going back to the point of democracy, if you think about it, the only wrong, if you're wrongfully arrested or you're wrongfully imprisoned, for example, or somebody assaults you, you were unfortunate enough to be assaulted by somebody on Thursday night when you were going about your business in Dublin and some thug attacked you and assaulted you. In the case of your good name, and only in the case of your good name, if you think about it, the right to free speech is what Mick Clifford is saying, or Bernard Barton, might say, is free to say. But in the case of your good name, the injury is done in the public. It's the publication of the defamation to other people. Yeah. So it's the injury to your reputation amongst members of the public that creates the wrong. So who better than the members of the public themselves to decide whether or not you have been defamed? I mean, that's the... So, yeah, the analogy with crime is this provision in recommended by the Oireachtas Joint Committee on Justice is pretty well approximate to that. It's saying the jury will decide whether or not there has been a defamation or whether there is a proper defence or not, but the judge will ultimately decide the amount of the award. And that, I would have thought, was a perfect compromise.
Yeah.
And I think it should be given a try. If it doesn't work, we can change it. But, I mean, it should be given a try. I think the problem is now is that the opposition are all lining up to take on the government on this. And so we're going to have a debate in due course. If this bill is introduced next year with this provision in it, you'll have a row in the Oireachtas, and the row will be, are you for or against the right to trial by jury? Instead of where we should be, and this is going back to a question you asked yourself, there are very important provisions for the change in the law on defamation, which are now being considered in the proposed legislation, this business about the coverage is a distraction from very important changes which need to be made. And I think I need to say to you in answer to the question about that, is that I welcome, as somebody who tried some of the most notable defamation actions in the last decade, I was the presiding judge. And I can say to you, including a case involving RTE, I can actually say to you that the provision, the proposal to simplify the Section 26 defence, that is the defence of fair and reasonable reporting.
Yeah.
Essentially, reasonable journalistic reporting on a matter of public interest. That defence should, in my view, be a go-to defence. So the simplification of that defence, in my view, will remove the chill factor that the media are always talking about. It needs to be changed. It's a very important change. I completely agree with it. From my own experience, what's there at the moment is too complicated.
Right.
It's even complicated for a judge. You know,
right.
I understand, and having listened to Michael McDougall in the Justice Committee talking about that, and he was the Minister.
Minister of Justice and Attorney
General at the time. You know, they were trying to, it was a catch-all. They were trying to take account of every possible scenario. And in doing that, they unintentionally overcomplicated it. And he himself was clear that it needed to be simplified. So I think that a concern that the media have for the right of free speech, especially in the digital area, and it's a genuine concern. But the two particular areas you've highlighted yourself, this idea that, which happened, of course, in the Keogh versus RTE case, where a panel member made comments of a highly defamatory nature, and literally in an instant during a... Well, if what is now being proposed is enacted, you know, RTE will be protected in this scenario. Or Mick Difford in an interview is going to be protected. Do you follow?
I do.
I mean, that's the whole idea. And the simplification of the Section 26, which is it's probably the most important, I would have thought, change that can be brought about. And I would have said the media's artillery should be pointed at that and not like Don Quixote at windmills on jury trial. These are the changes which need to be brought about. I've no reason to believe that my view on this is not shared by my colleagues.
Very good. Very good.
You know.
Can I ask you finally, Bernard, you're quite obviously still very active of mind and body well into your retirement. You're involved in compiling a fine book, The Men and Women of the Anglo-Irish Treaty Delegation 1921. And you're, as you say, you're still actively involved. Judges have to retire at 70. Would you see a scenario whereby they should be allowed to serve longer, or that they could move into another role within the judiciary in some form or another at that stage?
Well, fortunately, the grey matter is still functioning.
But that's the idea. Yeah.
And it's something I would personally love to be able to do. I know colleagues, retired colleagues, said that's it. They were glad.
Let me out the door.
and they've gone off to play golf or sail or whatever it is that they do, gardening, or whatever their activities are, and they're just finished, and they accept that they accepted that the day they were appointed, that when they finished, that would be it, and it's an interesting question, because earlier on in this interview, we talked about the terrible restrictions on the capacity of the courts to deal with the huge backlog of work that was building up, mainly because shortage of resources. In Northern Ireland and in the rest of the UK, you can come back.
Right, I didn't know that.
So basically, if you're now, provided you're physically up, I think until 75. I mean, I think 75, but as far as I know, 75 is the shut off point. But between 70 and 75, you can certainly serve. And so even if you have retired, you know, I think you have to retire at 70. But for example, the jury list sometimes finds itself, as I found myself, without a second judge. You need to have a second judge at least to move the list along in order to get the business done. If there was a shortage and the president of the High Court found himself, you know, short a judge, he could ring me up. If this was the North of Ireland, he could ring me up and says, could you give me a hand? Could you come and sit in the jury sessions this term or next term or whatever? And that happens regularly in Northern Ireland. I've met judges up there who are like this. They come back from retirement and they're essentially under license. So although they are retired, there's a specific legal provision, which means that the orders that they make are as if they were still a fully serving judge. So there's no constitutional infirmity, if you like, with the orders that they make while they're sitting. But of course, their power to make court orders or hear court exists only for so long as they are actually sitting in a court at the invitation, I think, of the Lady Chief Justice, as it happens in Northern Ireland. But this happens all the time in England, and it's a huge valve, so to speak, for letting off. And it also means that people, I mean, I think of some of the finest brains, legal brains, from the Supreme Court recently, now recent retirements, they're not from the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeal, they're gone, they're lost.
Yeah.
I think, Justin McCarthy, your own colleague in the Irish Times, who interviewed my colleague, Deirdre Murphy, you know, Justine herself said it in a very interesting article interview. They said that, you know, why should the state be deprived of the knowledge and expertise of these people because of a convention that they should say nothing? I have to say, Justine's article encouraged me to get involved.
Good stuff.
In this particular debate.
Listen, it's been a fascinating conversation. Bernard Barron, thank you very much for talking to us today.
You're very welcome.
That's it for today, folks. Hope you enjoyed that interview. I certainly found it very illuminating, I have to say myself. As always, I want to thank our engineer, JJ Vernon. Thank you for listening. Stay safe. Be well. We'll talk to you soon.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me? Like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.